Thank you, everybody, for coming along. This session is entitled A Comparison and Economic Analysis of International Solvency Regimes for Life Annuity Markets. It is a paper by Mathu Nimalendran and as well as Mike Sherris and Katja Hannevald. So we have all three authors here today, and Mathu will be doing a presentation, and Mike and Katja are here to assist. So Mathu is an honours graduate of the School of Risk and Actuarial Studies at the University of New South Wales. She is now an actuarial analyst at Finity Consulting Actuaries Proprietary Limited. She was awarded the University of New South Wales Co-op Scholarship for Undergraduate Studies, majoring in Actuarial Studies and Business Law, as well as the Australian Research Council Scholarship for undertaking honours in longevity risk research. She has also represented the university at the National Honours Colloquium, as well as the Australasian Actuarial Education and Research Symposium. She's also involved in the leadership teams of a number of local and international community organisations. So Mathu will give a short presentation, short to medium presentation, and then we'll open for questions. As usual, we have the microphone in the middle of the floor there, so if people could step to the microphone for their questions and give their names prior to asking questions, that would be great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hello, hello. So we'll be talking about an economic analysis and a comparison of international solvency regimes for life annuity markets. Now, I know this is the last session, so please bear with me. Let's get through it together. So, the four things that we'll sort of focus on today are the motivation behind this research and the actual objectives. What are we getting across with it? And then we'll look into the first part, which is the comparison of the different solvency regimes and the scope of this particular research. Then we'll look at an economic analysis, so a value maximisation, a simulation model of a life insurer offering annuities in order to find out which solvency regime would actually be optimal. And finally, we'll go through our findings and conclusions. So to start off with, the motivation. As we've seen or heard in this conference so far, longevity risk is an up-and-coming issue in society, and so many nations are faced with the task of providing solutions for an ageing population. Now, whilst there is a number of longevity products and existing, especially in Australia, the market for these doesn't really have much participation. So in order to enhance market participation, one way would be to have adequate regulation to increase prudential security so that we can encourage a lot more people to participate in such products. But when you want to increase prudential security, you also increase costs, which decreases in the end consumer affordability. So we've now got this balance that we need to effectively manage in order to enhance market participation. So what we do in this research, first of all, we look at international solvency regimes, and using a comparative framework, we compare them across the board in order to find out what's going on. In the second step, we then want to find out which of these solvency regimes is actually optimal, and we do this by using a multi-period value maximisation insurer model. So to start off with, let's compare the existing solvency regimes. So the three things we'll focus on in this section is we'll look at the scope and a general overview, the comparative framework that we use to look at these, and then finally some of the issues for insurers. So as we can see, the five regions that we are focusing on in this research consist of Australia, our own context, the United States, the UK, Switzerland, and the European Union, all which have developed or developing annuity markets or solvency regimes. Just briefly on each one, for Australia, we focus on the pre-LAGIC regulation, so the LPS standards. For the United States, we look at the risk-based capital, so the model law and the model formula. We then also look at, in the UK, we're looking at the ICAS system, so the International Capital Adequacy System, the Individual Capital Assessment System, sorry. And then in Switzerland, we're looking at the Swiss Solvency Test. And for the EU, we're looking at the almost implemented Solvency II. Now, there are a number of frameworks out there in literature which compare regulatory systems from international regulatory systems. But the one that we've decided to focus on is the Holzmuller one, which provides the criteria there. Firstly, we want a good system, according to this criteria, would be giving appropriate incentives for weaker companies to hold more capital. The formula for capital should also be more risk sensitive. It should also be appropriately calibrated to take into account confidence intervals, take into account time horizons, etc. We should also focus on the highest insolvency costs for the economy as a whole, and we should be using economic values or market consistent values. We should discourage misreporting, as it does exist. People do fiddle around with numbers in order to make sure that their capital requirements might be lower. And the formula should be as simple, as parsimonious as possible. And in Holzmuller, they added an extra four criteria when originally it was based on the Cummins one. But these four criteria enhance criteria for what a good system should have. So the eighth criteria here says a good system should be adequate in an economic crisis, in that it should anticipate systemic risk. So that when an economic crisis should happen, not all companies within this system get forced into that spiral of bad stuff going on, I guess, for want of a better word at the moment. Moving on, for criteria 9, a good system, according to the Sharma report, says that management should be assessed. So that criteria has been included here in order to make sure that a good solvency regime or an effective one exists. The 10th one looks at flexibility of the framework over time so that we can ensure that we're keeping up with developments and technological advancements. And the 11th one looks at having a risk management focus and market transparency. So that was the comparative framework. And just for the interest of time today, I've put up how we sort of went about valuing each of the regimes that we've looked at. And so just briefly today, some of the conclusions that we came up is, if you look at the US system, a lot of the moons are empty, and an empty moon's generally mean that the criteria hasn't been satisfied, whereas a full moon means that it has been satisfied. So with the US having a lot of empty moons, we can see that it has performed quite poorly in comparison to all the other systems. And this is in agreement with the Holzmuller paper, which also assessed the US system, and mainly because the US system came into play in the early 1990s, a good 15 years before all the other systems. If we look at the Switzerland and the German system, they tend to do, by German we really mean the EU, so Solvency II, they really have been quite consistent and satisfy these criteria quite well on the whole. However, the difference between our assessment of the Switzerland and the EU systems in comparison to the Holzmuller paper is in Criteria 3 and Criteria 8. Criteria 3 is looking at a formula should be appropriately calibrated. Now, the original criteria was for general insurance, whereas we're looking at life annuity products in particular. So in that sense, we're looking at a formula that needs to be calibrated over a much longer period of time. So we're looking at 30 years or so. However, in the existing systems at the moment, we look at a value at risk or an expected shortfall in the Swiss solvency test for 99.5% over a one-year horizon. So that's why we valued both the Switzerland and the Solvency II systems a little bit lower. The other point of difference was in Criteria 8, adequacy in an economic crisis and anticipation of systemic risk. So what we say is if we want solvency regimes to anticipate systemic risk, well, then all corporations shouldn't react to an economic event in the same way. However, in the regimes as they exist at the moment, whilst internal-based models are encouraged, a lot of insurers tend to do the same things and the same practices with regards to solvency requirements. So should an economic event occur, all insurers most likely will be reacting in the same way, which increases systemic risk. So that's why we've valued Switzerland, the Swiss solvency test, and the Solvency II a bit lower than previous assessments. In comparison, the Australian, the UK systems are fairly similar to the other two, and there are minor differences which we've noted in the paper in more detail. With this comparison, though, there's a couple of shortcomings which made that we needed to look into things more rigorously. Firstly, the original criteria was focusing on general insurance, as I mentioned earlier. But what we're looking at in particular is for life annuities and for life insurers, which gives it a different nuance on the criteria that might be needed. So in that sense, that's one area of improvement for comparing each of those systems using this criteria. Secondly, it's even though they're logical reasons and logical criteria for a good regulatory system, it's still pretty subjective. So this criteria provides a subjective assessment of each of the solvency regimes. And finally, the main purpose that I mentioned in my motivation was that we want to look at the regulatory trade-off, which system balances the regulatory trade-off, and this criteria here does not give us that. So what we've done is what we need in order to sort of address these shortcomings is to have a more rigorous and economic analysis, which brings us to the third part of our research. So the two things that we'll be focusing on is the life insurer value maximising model that we used in order to conduct this analysis, and then how we use that to find the optimal solvency levels and corresponding premium loadings. So firstly, what did we do? The objective of us simulating a life insurer who offered annuities to the market is so that we can assess the optimal capital and pricing strategy that a life insurer offering these annuities would use. And in order to do that, we had the life insurer with the optimal strategy would be one that's maximising expected profit, or EVA, which is enterprise value added. It's one where capital is subscribed right at the beginning of the period. We're also looking just at a default rate over a one-year horizon so that we can compare different default rates. And then because of timing constraints, we only looked at a few premium loadings, but which cover a wide range. So we've got 0, 5, 10, 15, and 20% premium loadings. And also, the different cases that we'll be considering for each of those insurers is that of the 99.9% solvency rating, 99.5, which is the one prescribed in Solvency II and the Swiss Solvency Test, and then 99 and 97 as well. So this graphically, yes. Sure thing. No, they're just lifetime annuities. Yeah, just the one product. So this brings us to a graphical representation of this insurer model. All the black arrows going in show us the different inputs that we use, and I'll go into more detail of each of those components soon. But we started off with a stochastic mortality model in there. We had an elastic demand curve in order to see how many annuities would be solved. We had a term structure model, as well as assets and investment returns backing the policy liabilities. And then we obviously included our expenses, our claims and our reserves, the initial capital that was subscribed, and also frictional costs, which all fed into our insurer model and spit out a simulation of our insurer profit and enterprise value added distributions. This insurer model is based on the Yao and Sheris paper, so we based heavily on that but modified it for multi-period and also life insurance, a life annuity product. So firstly, let's look at stochastic mortality. We incorporated stochastic mortality, and the mortality model was based on the Wills and Sheris model, where we took a stochastic diffusion process and applied it to the Australian male mortality rates for 65-year-olds. We extended the previous model so that it incorporated 50 to 110 ages, that is, and it was quite a good fit. And as you can see here, this was the expected and the 95% confidence intervals for our simulated survival curves. We then also took a price default risk demand curve established in Zimmer, Grundel and Shard and calibrated it for an Australian annuitant population. Now, this was a bit difficult because we don't have enough data. There isn't easily accessible data for an annuity population and the demand for such annuities. So as we can see here, this on this side looks at the 99.5% case of demand, and we tested for the price sensitivity. of the demand curve. And on the left-hand side, we have the default sensitivity of the demand. So that was just for a $70,000 premium at the start. And how would default change or how's the population sensitive to different levels of default? And which we tested for the various cases that I mentioned earlier. We also incorporated a term structure model, so a yield curve, which was essentially a simple Vasicek model, which we fit to the Bloomberg data as at the time of when we were doing the research, so last year. We then used this to simulate out future rates as well and the yield curve, which gave us discounting rates. Based on this, we looked at bonds, stocks and cash, and used an asset allocation that was mentioned in APRA's half-yearly life insurance bulletin. And we used a similar asset allocation between them for assets backing policy liabilities, with 87% in bonds, 8% in stocks and 5% in cash. For bond returns, we used the short rates simulated from the prior Vasicek model and generated those in order for the following year to come in order for us to get the bond returns. For stock prices and then for cash rates, we modelled them using a simple geometric Brownian motion. For premiums, we fixed the benefit, but in order to fix the benefit, we needed to have a look at how much would the initial upfront fair premium be. And for this, we looked at the Australian Bureau of Statistics and found that for an average male, approximately $70,000 would be their superannuation savings that they could put into a life annuity. So using that and the simulated mortality curves and yield curves, we found that at the end of each year, we'd be giving them a benefit of $5,149. And then initial capital, we subscribed from shareholders, so we came up with an algorithm in order to find for a given level of loading and a given level of default rate, how much capital do we need in order to maintain that default rate. Expenses, well, Challenger is one of the few companies that are actually still offering life annuities, so we took their 3.3% admin costs in order for our expenses just as a guide and went with that. For claims, well, it's the way we usually model claims. It's the total benefits that we pay at the end of the first year. So Q is the number of policies that we sell at the beginning of the year. A being the $5,150 benefit at the end of every year, and the probability of surviving 1 year is multiplied as well because we're just looking at that default rate over a 1 year period. We then also set up policy liability reserves in order to calculate profit. So we have the policy liability reserves being a combination of the net present value of our future liabilities and also the premium loadings, should we have them, to be weighted by the proportion of survivors. So if we put these... Oh, one more thing. Three, we also have frictional costs. These were established in the Yao and Sherish, and there were three types in there. So firstly, we have the taxation rate, which we've set to zero because of the imputation credit system we have in Australia. We also put in the agency costs of 2% times the capital that we subscribe, and also bankruptcy costs. Now, bankruptcy costs 15% is a bit of an arbitrary number, so we thought we'll test for sensitivity. So when we get to that, I can take you a little bit more through that. So this brings us to what the model spits out, and that's our profit distribution. So if we look at this profit and loss account. Thanks, Katja. We have on the income side, the way that we calculate a profit is we have our premiums plus our investment income, and from this we take away claims, expenses, frictional costs, and also the change in the reserve from the start of the year to the end of the year. Once we calculate our profit, we can then find our enterprise value added, which is essentially how much does our capital subscribed, if positive, offset our profit. So the reason why we can actually get negative capital subscribed is because we might have so much premium because of the loading that we do not actually need any extra capital in order to achieve the subscribed default rate. So in that sense, we've now got four cases which need to be considered when we want to calculate the enterprise value added. So in the first two cases, we look at where the capital subscribed is positive. If we get a profit, then that's our first case, and our EVA is equivalent to our profit. But if we get a loss, which is greater than our initial capital subscribed, then the offset amount would be the loss of that initial capital. If the initial capital subscribed is less than zero, so it's a negative capital, well then, if our profit is greater than zero, well then our enterprise value added would again be set to our profit because our shareholders did not actually subscribe any capital. And that's a similar reason why, should we get a loss, the enterprise value added is still zero because they did not subscribe to any capital at the start. So using this, we then found some results. So first we'll present a case-by-case analysis, and then we'll look at the sensitivity testing that we did to see if it affected our results, and then the final conclusions combining both sets of analysis. So if we focus on the 99.5% case, we found that we're looking at loadings and the corresponding initial capital that was subscribed that we found used our algorithm, and then we compared the EVA for each of those loadings. As we can see, we're getting this hump shape going on, and that's mainly due to the elasticity of demand. We find that our EVA peaks at 10%, which is great because Tony was telling us that their loadings are between 4% and 12%. So at 10%, we have an EVA, a maximum EVA, which is great. And then at 0%... we have negative EVA, and this is mainly because of the upfront costs. These are some of the numbers which we used, and we're looking at the EVA adjusted for cost of capital at the end. So we have the loadings that we specified earlier. We have the initial capital that is needed in order to maintain the 0.5% default probability. From this, we generate using our demand curve the quantity or the number that we buy. And premiums, and also the EVA from there. We then compared this across the other four cases that we looked at for different default rates. And as we can see, the results still remain the same. So at a loading of 10%, we still have maximum EVA. However, we can see that the demand curve plays a huge part because at a 3% default rate, we sell virtually a very small amount of annuities because of our demand curve. Whereas at a 0.1% in comparison to the others at a 10% loading, we have maximum EVA reached. So this makes us conclude that, well, the higher the solvency level, the better it is, I guess, for a company. We then did some sensitivity testing. So because of the difficulty of calibrating our demand function, we increased the default sensitivity and the price sensitivity of the function and compared the results. Now, for increased default sensitivity and for the price sensitivity, the pattern remains the same. The higher the solvency level, so the lower the default rate, the more EVA is generated. But as we can see here, again, in the more default case, 10% solvency level, 10% loading is still the maximum EVA generating loading. But on the other hand, for less price sensitive, we can see that it peaks at 20%, which is something interesting. But the conclusion still remains the same. The higher the default, the higher the solvency level, so the lower the default rate, the higher the EVA that we generate. We also looked at frictional costs because of the 15% assumption. We compared it for the 0.5% default case for 0% bankruptcy costs and 30% and found that our conclusions didn't change. And that's also because the probability of default being so small, the actual bankruptcy costs wouldn't have had much of an effect. So this brings us to our final conclusions. combining both our qualitative comparative assessment as well as our economic analysis. So in existing regulations, there are positives. We have principles-based approaches, which is much more flexible over time. We have a strong risk management focus in a lot of the existing regimes. There are two approaches for capital calculations. There's the prescribed approach as well as the internal model-based approach, meaning that we can, smaller insurers can use a less expensive way to calculate capital, and larger insurers can go about having a more effective and efficient way of calculating it. We use market valuation of assets and liabilities. We also have business strategies which have a future focus and have current risk management strategies. And there's also on-site examinations and off-site analysis with strong regulator involvement. There are also some limitations and improvements that we can look on. For example, a lot of the more complex risks have factor-based calculations, and this reduces the risk sensitivity overall of the capital calculations. We have similar internal models that are being used by a lot of insurers, so this increases the potential for more severe impact should there be a systemic event. Higher solvency levels, as we just found, maximise shareholder wealth and also satisfy consumer preferences for solvency. So in that case, perhaps the 99.5% solvency level that's being subscribed should actually be higher. And also, whilst there is some, there's no explicit regulation which mandates public disclosure and financial reports being disclosed to the public. So those are some of the conclusions that we came. And that ends our presentation. So are there any further comments or questions?
Thank you, Matthew, for that. So just, open to questions. And can I just ask that you come to the microphone, and I know Bazana didn't do it before, but she was...
What needs to change in regulation for us to sell more annuities, because we don't sell many annuities in Australia?
What needs to change in regulation? Well, yeah, so some of the things that we talked about are essentially the way we calculate capital. A higher solvency level would definitely go about improving that. We have a population which is highly sensitive to default, so the higher the solvency probability, that would induce more annuities being sold, we think. We also think that making calculations more risk-sensitive, involving less factor-based calculations, as was the case in the US, and as we do for operational risk calculations, that would definitely increase risk sensitivity and hence hopefully enhance market participation. And also, there's a range of things, but these are just a few of them. So, yeah.
Yes, I think that's part of the famous annuity puzzle.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is probably a more behavioural economics question than this one. Other questions at the moment? I might. Oh, yep, Bazana.
I have a few questions, but I didn't understand some of these. The first one was this is a simple question. What mortality basis did you use?
So we used a stochastic mortality. So we looked at past Australian data and then projected it forward into the future to incorporate the longevity improvement or the mortality improvements that we've been seeing.
So did you start with one of the standard tables?
No, so we simulated it out.
The number of deaths in the Australian population,
that's right, and then we simulated it out.
Mm. Yep. And then, I'm sorry, I couldn't write my question very well because I can't see the page numbers on the slides, but quite early on, you talked about the default.
Also, we were talking about default rate for an insurer. So should an insurer go bust, they won't be able to pay out on their annuities. So that was the default rate that we were referring to, and hence the solvency level.
Mm-hmm. I was having real trouble following
Sure.
So presumably you've got your 4 points there.
Mm-hmm. So that would be profit at time one. So I just took the notation straight out of the paper. And so at time one, we're looking at profit, which is at the end of the year, not at the beginning. So that's what the profit one's looking at. But the four cases there, the first one is saying enterprise value added is how much does the capital that we subscribe offset the profit that we've made? So in the first case, when we get the capital subscribed being positive, then if we make a profit, then our enterprise value added would be the profit. But if we make a loss, then the enterprise value added, and if that loss is greater than the capital that we subscribe, then our enterprise value added would actually just be the negative capital that we've subscribed, because yeah. Hmm.
It's a single period calculation.
Right.
It's multi-period. Or 6 years to see.
Some of the other EDS I can't get either, but just on a general basis, you've concluded that the more solvency you have, the more solvency you certainly have, the better it is. But wouldn't that make the cost to the person in the street, especially here in Ireland, less likely?
Yep, so we've taken that into account with the cost of capital as well as... This one.
So we have preferences for individuals buying a new business, and this is kind of calibrated so that there's a willingness to buy on the left-hand side in a sense, and then as the premium loading goes up, you're less willing to buy. So if you have a 40% loading, no one's going to buy. If you have a zero loading, then not everybody's going to buy, but about you'll get 40% of the market, if you like. And that's what we calibrate for price sensitivity. The default sensitivity says, well, if you have
the default is the insured default.
Yeah, so yes, so the insurer, yeah, not meeting its obligations, right? So this is XYZ company, they're fully, massively capitalized.
Sorry?
Occidental, there's one that went broke.
Ah. Well, there's
some particular issues around
there. There's upfront to say we're buying something from this company that has a certain level of capitalisation. Right? We just meet the 99.5, we have much higher capitalisation. The more highly capitalised, the more likely you will sell business. And as you get lower and lower in your capitalisation, so you're a dud, then no one can buy from you.
So in other words, a higher premium for Challenger than will for Occidental and Regal.
Yeah.
Yes, particularly today. And actually, sorry, just while we're on that particular subject, can I just ask, so the probability of default, because you've done the value maximisation on economic value added as an absolute amount rather than return on capital, the demand sensitivity is really just driven by, I guess, the amount you sell. So your return on capital doesn't actually change based on your demand sensitivity, it's only the absolute economic value added?
Well, the capital subscribed is determined by your initial default and the loading you start with.
Right.
But once you fix those two, then you've got a fixed quantity.
Yeah, so when your demand curve changes, that doesn't change the insurer's return on capital. Because their amount of capital for a given default probability doesn't change, and all the loadings are sort of proportional. Correct. So, yeah, okay.
We don't calculate returns.
Yes.
So your conclusion was based on that premium loading that you should have a 10%. Sorry, based on the sensitive demand, you should have a 10% loading to your premium to maximise profit for the company.
That's right. Thank you.
And I might just add a little bit of extra information on the passing comment about Challenger's loadings, that the loading percentages I mentioned are actually ex post, in that we work out a return on capital, and so we don't actually work it out on a 1 plus K kind of basis as is set out in the paper. Ian.
Ian Robbins. I'm glad that point about solvency was asked, because I was flummoxed by that for a while until I had a penny drop, and I realise now way you said it, but maybe I've passed over it, did you say, where does the fault sensitivity that the chart had showed on the YSL, where did that come from? Does it assume that the buyers of annuity are aware of, fully aware of these default sensitivities? I wonder where the buyers of life insurance paid any recognition at all to the security of life insurance companies. They just take it as a given. They're there, they exist, and they'll be around for however long to pay their annuity. They never consider that default possibility. In other words, annuities are not really fully guaranteed. They cannot be. No insurance product can.
So we could map these default probabilities back to insurer ratings. So there's actually tables by AM Best where you can, for the US market, an average life insurer ratings, then get back to default probabilities. So there's, but we first often presented these insurer ratings, and then we had a lot of troubles with people saying, well, ratings and rating agencies are not a good institution, so we put that part out because... it is the default probability. We're not saying that it can be 100% certain. It would be too expensive. It's a trade-off in our model. So there's cost of capital. You can either hold your own capital. The question is, how do you establish capital? Does it come from shareholders or does it come from policyholder loadings?
It's just a curve like that. Mm. Correcting the level of elasticity.
So,
and I would have expected consumers would be relatively inelastic because they just don't have that knowledge, they don't think about that.
Well, it's going back to this research that my colleagues in Berlin did, where they did a lab experiment and they invited a range of students, but also non-university members, and they presented to them, here is your coin collection, and imagine this can be there could be a theft in the next year. We offer you insurance. What are you willing to pay for this insurance? And then afterwards you say, well, now imagine there's three different providers. One has a default probability of 1%, one has 2%, but 3%. And what happens is when people, first of all, they realize insurers can go bankrupt, then they go and you find that the curve drops very steeply. So whenever you introduce a little bit of default probability, people don't like it at all.
Yeah. So I think the reality is consumers are just not aware of that.
Yeah. I am going to ask another question.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume in this analysis that the client actually knows the information. The client knows what the story is. The reality that you're speaking of, most clients probably don't know. But the assumption here is that they do know. However, they do know something. So, for example, when Challenger took over the MetLife portfolio, some policyholders, much to my chagrin, actually stayed with MetLife because they felt that if they moved to Challenger, they'd be going with a weaker organisation, and therefore they wanted to stay with a stronger organisation, so they stayed with MetLife. So, policyholders kind of know, but they don't perfectly know, but that's it. Yeah. That might just be awareness, brand awareness.
There are a few things involved in that particular case, but I think I guess my view on this, it does assume that people know and know to a reasonably granular extent about the default probability of a company. I think that there is work that is actually done on that, maybe not for individuals, but advisors when and dealer groups are putting together approved product lists, they go and do reviews of the credit worthiness of particular companies, but I think what you're saying is probably right, that it is far more a cliff, that it's either you're considered credit worthy or you're not. It's not a curve as such. It just is. It's far more binary than is suggested by a curve like that.
Well, therefore, I would say with the conclusion is in a perfect market, which is transparent, where we all have full information, we don't need a regulator. There will be a play of supply and demand, and the policyholders will see the default risk and make up a willingness to buy this product, and that's at some point where these two curves intercross, there will be a market. But we don't have this actually, and that's why we need a solvency regulation that sets a lower floor. That's why it's good to have a 99.5% guaranteed for those customers that don't look up insurer ratings, so you know that the APRA establishes quite a lower barrier.
It also assumes in the Australian market, at least, that consumers are not aware of the capital differences between annuities. I know we're talking about life annuities, but perhaps if we can draw it to term certain annuities compared to term deposits. That argument about the difference between the two capital regimes there. Because I think that's perhaps partly in line with your question too, that consumers will look at price, and at the moment they might evaluate a term deposit relative to a term certain annuity, a short term one at least. If the banking one is a better proposition purely on price alone, they're not going to consider the possibility of the brand defaulting, or even how much what the default is implied by default rate is implied by the capital that they're holding. Not any of that. So. Look, to me, it was a great presentation. I enjoyed it. I think it came from the solvency is not my pet subject, but it was a really good presentation. And I was hoping that the manager would give a more practical application to it. And I'll leave that to Andrew, but maybe you might say there is.
All right.
You'd be better judge of that than me.
Well, thank you very much for your attendance. Thank you, Matthew, for the. For the presentation. Can I ask you to thank Matthew and also Mark and Patrick for the presentation?